And just to say, Farah, I'll give you a 2-minute warning on the chat so you know where you are.
If I'm okay, thank you, I appreciate that. Okay, so thank you for the introduction, Jess. Yes, so our work, as our namesake is to really just raise awareness on the issue of sexual harassment across the continent and develop comparative assessments by looking at laws in other regions as well. That way we can identify gaps and just develop best practice benchmarks as well. So of course we had in 2020, this is during the COVID time, we took advantage of doing things online. And so we had 3 focus group discussions that were supposed to take place in person, but because of COVID, we had to revert to the online strategy, which worked quite well. We got the same information. So we had 3 focus group discussions on experts on sexual harassment and violence in South Africa. And we identified 3 groups. And the first was lawyers, the second was workers, and the third was media. And so I'm going to focus a little bit more on the information that we were able to extrapolate from the lawyers. But just to say that the information from lawyers, workers, and media does strongly intersect with the challenges on gender-based violence and sexual harassment in South African universities. And I'll explain a little bit why. And so my next slide. So under the lawyers focus group discussion, we had 3 issues that really came out quite strongly. The first was the vicarious liability that we discussed in detail with one of the presenters. And one of the pointers was Section 60 of the Employment Act, the Equity Act, which provides for statutory vicarious liability of the employer. And then, and so from these presentations, I just kind of just had to narrow the things that were of greatest interest. So I noted that an employer once informed of sexual harassment, a sexual harassment incident is required under the code to take reasonable steps and to investigate and address the complaint. This is not something which is dissimilar to what you find in other laws that exist in a lot of African countries, where you have to, where there is a requirement that you have to make the employer aware of the sexual harassing behavior. And I remember we raised this issue of the, you know, the additional burden that was placed on a survivor to report, and how this was almost like an escape route for an employer to just then raise the issue of saying that, well, I was not informed, or it was not expressed to me adequately that there was this case of sexual harassment ongoing. And there are even some policies in universities. There's one policy that we studied where they actually stipulate in that policy that the survivor should have made it very clear, first of all, to the harasser, made it very clear to the harasser that they're not interested, and then secondly, to have reported. So you see this trend of placing this unreasonable burden on a survivor, and yet at the same time, it's also coupled by a lack of a structural support system, you know. We think that if you are going to expect a survivor or potential complainant to take these measures of reporting, we think there should be an additional burden for ensuring that there are structural systems in place that support the reporting process, and that if there are not, there should be penalties that are coupled with that. And this is also what I believe is a problem within the university context as well. Another issue that was raised was sexual harassment outside work. This was actually our second presenter at that focus group discussion, who pointed out that just based on the study that she had been doing, that you know, she believed that, and she was actually referring to the university setting, that there was really just a gap in terms of defining sexual harassment outside of a workplace. However, my response has been to that, you know, to that expectation is that I think that the solution really lies in the expansion of the definition of workplace and who are the different actors within a workplace context. So the power dynamics, for example, an example that I gave is that the power dynamics of, you know, let's just say a professor who sexually assaults a student off campus, those same power dynamics exist within that institution. So, you know, the fact that it didn't happen specifically within the university does not take away the liability and the responsibility of such an institution to intervene and really kind of take responsibility for the actions of an employer just because it took place outside of a, you know, very sort of specific workplace setting. Yes, so then there are questions of who is an employer, who is an employee. Of course, in the university setting, you're also looking at who is a student. And the different categories of students, you've got different categories, and those also need to be really, really clearly articulated when you are wanting to have a holistic approach to protecting all persons around a university. So the next presenter that we had talked about challenges in the disciplinary system and sexual offenses that occur on campus. And one issue that we looked at was the need to redefine what an administrative process should look like and the concern of how the disciplinary process in university settings usually took on almost like a criminal sort of, it had like a criminal component to it that was, had some, you know, disadvantages. I think that the criminal aspect is important to the extent that it really underscores the severity of the offense, of the abuse that a complainant or a survivor has suffered. But at the same time, because you are, you know, it's a disciplinary process, there is an, you know, there is an aspect where you kind of have to tailor, you have to tailor make this process to suit a setting that may be finding a middle ground between civil and criminal, and not purely from a the criminal side, which is very intimidating for many survivors and is actually a hindrance to speaking out. And so from these three presentations, we just, you know, we couldn't list everything that the key issues that came out of there. The first one that I thought would be relevant for this discussion as well was addressing the lack of adequate protection resulting from the definition of sexual harassment, which occurs outside the workplace. I believe that the expansion of the definition of workplace is very important. And I'm glad that we find that expansion in international conventions like the C-190, which I think really has a very comprehensive definition of workplace setting. And then reassessing the duty of care versus reputational harm. These are things that we see repeatedly where if a university has, maybe any institution really has an opportunity to protect their reputation and really throw a survivor or victim to the wolves and not you know, really emphasize the duty of care first, they will do that because they consider the protection of their institution as most important. Another element to this is, of course, who the reputation of the sexual harasser in question. You know, if it is someone who brings in a lot of money for the university, someone who is a star academic person, who brings a lot of advantage to the university, there is a tendency to kind of silence the voices. And so what is the solution there? You know, I find that some of the cases that we have studied.
2 minutes remaining. It's 2 minutes remaining.
So yes, and then the other issue is the legality of the use of non-disclosure agreements to settle with victims of sexual harassment. It is an issue. It's not as loud as we have seen in other regions, but it does exist. And sometimes even the culture of a disciplinary process can be a form of an NDA as well. The confidentiality that they use to ensure that information regarding that process is not exposed is actually creating more harm, because sometimes you find that a sexual harasser who is an educator within that institution is released back into the teaching fold, and then you have a next crop of students coming in who are unaware that, you know, you have a problematic person because of this issue of confidentiality and NDAs. And then the other issue that was raised specifically in the context was the validity of the provision under the EEA, which renders the remedy of Section 68 unavailable to victims who fail to report incidences of sexual harassment to an employer. And the solution was that this was something that had to be interrogated further. Yes, so one of our presenters at that focus group discussion, specifically at her institution, education institution, at UCT, had talked about how they had two disciplinary structures. One was for staff who would go through the human resource management, and then one was for the student disciplinary panels. So that has its advantages and disadvantages. One issue then again is within the same disciplinary system is that sometimes, you know, you would have like a panel of a panel who would be presiding over a disciplinary hearing who basically don't have the expertise to deal with issues of gender-based violence or harassment. And so they treat offenses such as plagiarism, cheating, almost in a similar way as sexual offenses and rape. And we know this by just looking at their credentials, that this person is may have the qualifications to preside over a case that is dealing with plagiarism, but that doesn't necessarily mean that you have the qualifications to preside over a sexual offense case. So that goes back to the panel composition, a problematic area, lack of training and expertise in the area of GBV, and one other disadvantage being that the respondent's right to legal representation, especially if there was the potential of an expulsion, that, you know, this is something that a respondent would likely be privileged to have, unlike the complainant. And then also, we also saw that there were efforts to tailor-make sexual harassment policies within education institutions, to tailor-make them and make them more progressive and to really respond to issues of GBV in a more gender-sensitive way. But then at the same time, you then see that there are challenges, hurdles in the form of implementation and monitoring. So the process of revising your sexual harassment policies becomes very difficult if you're not able to overcome the hurdle of implementation and monitoring. And who is responsible for implementation and monitoring It is an insult to survivors to develop beautiful policies that speak very well on issues of GBV, but then when it comes to actual implementation and monitoring, nothing is done. It's not matching.
Could you, brilliant, perfect, wrap up?
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you so much. That was a fantastic presentation and so full of information, which I'm sure people will want to unpick during the Q&A. So thank you so much. I'm going to move over now to the third panelist that we have speaking today, who is Joel Quirk, who is a professor of politics at the University of Wits. His research focuses on enslavement and abolition, work and mobility, gender and violence, historical repair, and the history and politics of Africa. Joel's most recent co-edited work is entitled Research as More Than Extraction, Knowledge Production and Gender-Based Violence in African Societies. And the title of the paper is Oral Histories of Gender-Based Harms, Equity and Liability at the University of Witwatersrand. Over to you, Joel.
Hello everyone, can you hear me okay?
Yeah, we can hear you and we can see your screen.
Excellent. So I want to take this opportunity to thank everyone for their contributions today and for this opportunity to talk to you at all about a project which I must confess I'm slightly anxious and nervous about, because it's the first time I've actually presented on this. This is not my primary area of expertise, but it's something that I've taken up in more recent times, and I'm looking to share some preliminary thoughts with you about some of the things I've found. So this project is entitled Oral Histories of Gender-Based Harm, and it specifically focuses on questions of equity and liability at the university at which I work. And what I want to specifically do is provide a brief, yet hopefully somewhat granular account of the last 10 years of institutional reforms and efforts that are designed to address gender-based harm amongst members of the Wits University community. So I'm going to focus specifically on the key office, the Gender Equity Office, that was established by the university in 2014. Snapshot of the kinds of things that I think have faced this office in the course of the last decade. So in terms of the backstory, I'm a white foreign male professor within post-apartheid South Africa, and here we have to recognize that the post isn't especially post a lot of the time, and Wits as a university shouldn't be regarded as representative of higher education in South Africa more generally. It's an historically white university positioned in the heart of Johannesburg, and it has forms of kind of wealth and positionality and status that differentiate it from many of its other peers in South Africa. So I moved to Wits roughly 11 years ago. And as part of that move, I ended up by accident in a department that was the epicenter of a sexual harassment scandal at the university. And through a kind of complicated series of events I don't have time to go into, I ended up firstly as a member of an advisory committee established by the university to try and address policy in these issues. And I've more recently been the co-chair of that committee. And as part of my role in this process, I've been engaged in questions of policy reform and policy design. So I'm not going to pretend to be standing apart from the events I describe. I'm kind of implicated and connected in them in all kinds of ways. And as part of that process, I've more recently undertaken a new project, which is designed to try and capture the perspectives and experiences of people who have dealt with questions of gender-based harm within the VITS community. So this project I started last year. I've so far done 33 semi-structured interviews with staff, students, executives, frontline service providers within the VITS community. It's an insider-outsider approach where a lot of the people I've talked to as part of this project are people I've known previously, people that I'm connected with, not all of them, but some of them. I'm not asking them about theory, but I'm instead trying to get a sense of their perspectives and experiences of the way in which the university has sought to address questions of gender-based harm. So as part of this process, I am in the process of transcribing these interviews. I then send them back to the people I've talked to, who get to edit and refine them and decide whether or not that they're comfortable with the transcript as given. I then have to make sure it doesn't expose any questions of legal liability or deal with questions associated with cases and confidentiality. And I'm proposing and intending and hopefully will later this year publish these interviews as a Creative Commons online archive. And that's part of a kind of understanding of how knowledge is constructed and deployed, where I want this project to capture experiences in ways that benefit everyone and not simply the person doing the interview. I have some complications in terms of who I can talk to and where my ethics approval covers or ends, and I'm not really in a position to go into the details. So in terms of what I want to cover, this is an extremely brief and superficial dive. I have more content than I can realistically handle in 10 minutes, so I'm hoping to simply cover the top lines. And the top lines start in late 2012 with a report in a student newsletter, which made reference to a professor asking a student for sex. And one of the key kind of elements of the conversation at this time was there was a great deal of uncertainty as to which professor was the subject of the article. And one of the distressing things about this was that there was no shortage of potential credible candidates. Eventually, over the course of a six-month period and following a front page expose in the Sunday Times, four members of staff were eventually subject to disciplinary proceedings. And the framework that was used here is the idea of VITS sex pests. Now, there's problems with the sex pest framing. It kind of is a diminutive. It kind of implies kind of a kid being a pest and has the kind of danger of trivializing and kind of reducing kind of the seriousness of the allegations. Crucially, these were all members of academic staff, and the fact that there was four of them within a short period of time created a sense that the university as a whole was facing not simply the euphemistic bad apples, the isolated incidences that can be kind of excused and minimized as people having individual failings. It was because of the scale and number of the allegations understood to be a systemic problem. So I'm interested in what happens next, how far the reforms initiated by the university went and what the questions of design look like. So how do you design a policy and institutional response to questions of gender-based harm? Now, the framing of gender-based harm, to my mind at least, is hopefully able to capture more than spectacular violations of bodily integrity, which seem to be the kind of standard of sexual violation and gender-based violence that everyone in South Africa theoretically agrees they are against, but in practice very comfortably and easily pushed to the side as being something over there. But it's the larger questions of harm and hierarchy and the abuse of power that at a university such as this, I think, are crucial yet uncomfortable conversations to have. So in terms of how, sorry?
3 minutes.
Oh, okay, I'm in trouble then. In terms of how this worked, we have the idea that WITS took this seriously. We have academic members of staff being fired. We have an independent inquiry. We have the establishment of new institutional architecture. And we have a new vice chancellor who took this as an opportunity to burnish his credentials in all kinds of ways and was deeply and directly involved in various policies and not always for the better. We have new policies, and given the timelines, I'd like to say more about this, but I think I will probably have to skip. We have the establishment of the Gender Equity Office. It's designed to have its functions and budget removed from the Transformations Office, separately located in the Vice Chancellor, which was designed to resolve a problem associated with reporting lines being compromised by academic hierarchies. You instead create a reporting line that is entirely separate, at least theoretically. The office, in terms of its mandate, is designed to kind of transform society, deal with the legacies of apartheid, deal with questions associated with gender and sexual discrimination. And yet it's historically had kind of 3.5 people, and then more recently has kind of a few more, but there's a mismatch between its capacities in terms of the people working on its mandate and the mandate itself. And as a consequence, it's historically been reduced to a situation where cases, disciplinary cases, counseling of people who've experienced harm become its core business. And there's invariably, as part of this, a tension between activism, the capacity of the office to transform the university, liability, what the legal office says can happen, and public relations, where having an office such as this one invariably creates a situation where, in addition to having a mandate to try and address gender harm, that having an office is designed as a public relations ploy, which you can point to in order to placate critics or create the appearance of taking something seriously, despite the fact that in terms of resources and capacities, there's a mismatch between what you say the office does and what it can actually manage. I have a timeline, I'm just gonna have to skip. And I just maybe summarize, given that time is short, a few points that I think have emerged from the interviews. To be clear, I'm not going to quote from any of the interviews, but there are some themes that emerge that I think are worthwhile highlighting. The first, and I think this is the most important point, gender equity is much bigger than cases and counseling. And I don't mean to suggest here that cases and counseling are important, but there's a sense that having a gender equity office never quite gets to equity with the intensity and resources that one might hope or expect, because 90% of the resources are used up in reactive mode, dealing with disciplinary cases, dealing with counseling. So there's a mismatch there. The second point is that disciplinary proceedings. Sorry? I can't. It's cut out. This is my last slide. I'll be quick. WITS disciplinary procedures are handling cases which might otherwise go through criminal justice mechanisms due to justified suspicion of the South African Police Service and prosecution. Cases involving academic staff, rock star professors have tested institutional systems to a much greater extent. And despite some notable cases where professors have been fired by the university, there remains a huge reluctance to say who they are and what they were fired for. And this includes the case that recently went through the South African CCMA, took hundreds of thousands of hours of time, and is a landmark case of gender bullying and harassment, where a professor was fired by the university and that decision was upheld. Yet the university, from its public relations and public statements, has said nothing about. So there's large numbers of cases where allegations and disciplinary proceedings remain undigested and festering within different corners of the university. Having a specialized office enables the university to both delegate and deflect collective responsibility by passing all responsibility to this small unit. And then finally, and I guess this is obvious already, all of this activity can only realistically capture a small corner of the larger set of issues associated with gender-based harm at a university such as this.
Thanks so much, Joel. That was another fantastic presentation. I think what we're going to do is hand over to the other Jess on the call to conduct a Q&A. And just to say as well, there's been some comments in the chat about the recording. We will speak to Khurata about capturing her presentation as well, so that it can be shared in some way. So I think I will hand over now to Jess Bruecke to conduct the Q&A. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Jess and Adrija, and to the three really outstanding panelists. When Adrija asked me to kind of help co-chair this event today, I told, like, gave her a forewarning that this is not at all my expertise. I study boats, but my kind of interest in this topic is from being a student at kind of two big South African universities and having, you know, experienced these processes myself and supported friends who've had to go through these processes and been a lecturer and had students go through these processes. And I've always found them very difficult and kind of overwhelming. And so what I'm going to do today is take advantage of this panel to kind of ask a question that's been plaguing me. And just to also quickly say that, please, those who have questions, just to put them in the chat box and I will kind of get to them afterwards. So my question to the whole panel is kind of connected to something that Faraha asked, well, Faraha mentioned in her session about this kind of the criminalized, overly bureaucratic processes and how really often it is kind of this criminalized process that makes the survivor or the person coming forward feel particularly uneasy. And I think this is really interesting, because kind of often these overly criminalized or kind of carceral responses, when they do happen, not that they do often, are pitched as something that is to the detriment of the accused, right? That it's like kind of overly carceral, overly criminalized processes can only be to the detriment of the accused. But I think it's really interesting in that how it can also put off people coming forward, or kind of people naming their perpetrators. And so again, going back to what Joel just said about desire, like the policy design of a desired outcome, I think is really interesting. And I'm interested in how universities kind of come to this idea of what a desired outcome is in these processes. And kind of going back to the very beginning to Khurata, is you know, we saw these incredibly moving images in your presentation, and I saw myself in one of them, which was kind of weird, lying on the Vitz floor in my really ugly beige bra. But I think it's, you know, moments like that where students are coming together, calling for something, demanding something, wanting justice, but not always, and I say not always, because I know that very often they do know exactly what they want, but not always knowing what the desired outcome is. And I think I'm kind of particularly interested in this, as I'm very interested in how theory travels. And I know, you know, Ruth Wilson Gilmore just visited South Africa, and abolition is very topical. But I think that, you know, how kind of these anti-carceral feminists talk about abolition in the North doesn't always fit to our context in the South, and doesn't always fit to our context in South Africa. And so I think I'm really interested in hearing more from the three of you on this idea of a desired outcome to these processes, which I know is a big question, but like I said, I'm taking advantage of the expertise on the panel. So Khurata, are you kind of okay to go first? I'd also just like to say, I know often in these panels, it's not a lot of time is given to kind of speak to each other. And I did see in the chat that there was, you know, a lot of overlap. So if you'd like to kind of you speak to each other as panelists, that's also great.
Okay, so I would say when it comes to desired outcomes, and I'm assuming that you're referring to a disciplinary process. When it comes to a desired outcome, you have to look at it from two perspectives. In fact, there are two perspectives. Actually, there are three, but sometimes the perspective of in an educational institution, and sometimes a very influential multinational organization, there should be three perspectives, but the two get merged and confused, you know? So the perspective and the expectations of the accused, the perspective and expectation of the institution can become blurred, you know, because both of them may have a tendency to want to protect the institution. And that is where a victim or complainant often finds themselves very at a disadvantage. In educational institutions, there is also, you know, when you kind of blend in the criminal overtones of a disciplinary process, you may find that the burden of proof that is applied may not work in favor of a complainant. Not that necessarily that it should, but then it's also about fairness, because if you are applying, for example, a burden of proof that includes that where you're using the standard of proof beyond reasonable doubt, then you're really expecting that process to use a standard that is, you know, the same as a, you know, criminal court case, you know. And in that process, you have a complainant, a student who doesn't have the same tools, the same access to legal advice and legal support that the institution has itself, and that the accuser may have. And then the other burden of proof would be, of course, the balance of probability. So this is why I think that there has been recommendations that a disciplinary process should be something that is more tailored to towards using that standard of balance of probability. But because the process itself, you know, is really layered with very protective mechanisms and protecting the institution, sometimes it's really difficult to really get key insight from the outside in terms of what standards are they using. But then also, even if you're applying the proof beyond a reasonable doubt, it should be clear that proof beyond reasonable doubt does not necessarily mean, it should not equate to proof beyond a shadow of a doubt. And sometimes that is a mistake that the institutions make when they are, you know, conducting these disciplinary processes. And usually it's quite deliberate as well.
Yes, thank you. Joel, have you had a moment to read Anna's question in the chat? No, that's fine. It's kind of related to my question. And I was
sorry. Do you want me to try and bundle them, or
if you can? Otherwise, I'm happy for you to do one, and we can come back to it. I do think that they're linked, but
yeah. So I kind of did the running too fast thing, and that invariably ends up in a situation where kind of some of the nuance drops. In terms of the kind of overlap between internal disciplinary proceedings and criminal proceedings, there's obviously things you can do through an internal proceeding that you can't do through a criminal proceeding. You can kind of move people to different residences. You can engage in a kind of no communication or contact order. There's kind of remedial measures that can be implemented immediately on a kind of like now timeline, rather than the types of laborious extended processes associated with criminal justices. So I wouldn't want to suggest that one is a substitute for the other. They have kind of different competencies and they can be employed in different ways. At the same time, I also think that your conception of desired outcomes is tied to a set of expectations about what is realistically likely to occur. And if you have diminished expectations of your institutions, and South Africans, for very good reasons, have diminished expectations of the South African Police Service and Criminal Justice Service, it kind of constrains your understanding of what a remedy might look like. So I do think that there's a critique that can and should be made of kind of, you know, punitive carceral solutions, but people aren't selecting their desired remedies in a context where all the options are realistically on the table. And as a consequence of that, you can end up where, what do you really want? Well, I would really like to just be left alone. And I think one of the biggest problems we have is that in terms of desired outcome, people would really desire to not have someone else go through the same trauma that they experience. And we have huge problems in South Africa due to these considerations around liability, where members of academic staff get fired for gross misconduct and gender bullying and harassment, and they go and get other jobs. And students get fired for similarly egregious conduct, and they go and re-register at universities just down the road. And because these proceedings remain confidential and there's no record that is easily discoverable and circulatable, there's a very high chance that you're kind of setting up a situation where people will kind of re-offend in another context. So I think it's complicated. I do think that the whole idea that everyone needs to go to jail has been necessarily and justly complicated, but the kind of transitional justice mechanisms that people often celebrate aren't perfectly chosen in a free context. They're also tied up in a limited set of expectations of institutions.
Thank you, Joel.
Really interesting.
Oh, sorry.
Right. I was just saying thank you. I'll post, if it's not too much self-advertising, I'll post a link to the project that Erin and I have just been working on, in case, because I think there's quite a lot of similarity.
Thank you. Kurata?
Can you just rephrase your question?
No, that's fine. I think when I'm thinking about desired outcomes, but when I am thinking about your presentation, I think it's kind of this two things that come to mind. One is, I've always been so interested in the RU reference list, particularly in why roads, like why it happened at Rhodes. And I find that incredibly interesting, whereas, you know, this is like Joel has explained, and in my experience at UCT, it's not an issue that I think is specific to any one institution in South Africa, but really university currently known as Rhodes was the space where it kind of exploded, and where, you know, students and feminists really pushed this issue. And I'm interested to hear your thoughts around that. And then I think kind of when I am thinking about desired outcomes in the context of the RU reference list is, as students and activists and protesters, you know, was there any clear insight into what it was that they were, you know, demanding more than just this overwhelming desire to feel safe, which I think is always, you know, difficult to articulate in policy, which of course is the desired outcome. So I think that is kind of broadly my questions to you, if you're able to respond.
Cool. So in terms of like why Rhodes, I think that at the time there was a lot of mobilizations which meant that our protest got a lot of attention. So I think it's partly about how we organized and the fact that we had, in collaboration with other students at UCT and Stellenbosch, we'd planned this campaign under the banner Chapter 212. So there had already been, before like the explosion of RU reference list, there was this coordinated campaign to stand up against like university administrations on this issue. And then when the list of names went viral, I think that part of what caused the response was the way the university had responded to the Chapter 212 campaign, which was that it was like a poster campaign where we had all of these posters that talked about rape culture being institutional and Rhodes University hiring perpetrators, them being student leaders, that sort of thing. So those posters were taken down twice. And I think that even though it was like a physical display, like outside the library, Rhodes is and was at that time a very digitally connected campus. So there's this kind of like, and these events were publicized. So when the university responds by taking down the posters, everyone is observing it digitally, which I think caused a lot of anger. And then, you know, coming off of the Fees Must Fall protests, maybe 7-8 months before, there was also an understanding that when there's a problem, we're going to protest. So how RU reference list happened, according to my memory and like my readings and stuff, was that in the same vein as Fees Must Fall protests, there was like a student body meeting called, and that's how people ended up gathering. And you know, it's very much a fallist protest in that when Fees Must Fall happened and there was the campus shutdowns, that became how we organized. So I think like those are the things that made it such a big attention grabbing kind of protest, or at least some of the things. And I think that also like our digital activism has been a significant part of this story, because we've kept the narrative of the story alive through continuous mobilization, broadcasting different movements. And anytime something happened, for instance, most of the times Yolanda Janti had a court hearing, we would mobilize and make sure that people on Twitter knew about it. So in that way, we also got connected to media, and that's how the story grew and was sustained. And in terms of demands, it's a big can of worms. And in terms of like anticipated and desired outcomes, one of the main things that I think never happened at Rhodes University which might have changed the course of the protests, is that the university's narrative around the protests made it seem that they were not implicated directly by us, like saying that you are the problem. The problem is with the administration's ineptitude around this. And the way they tell the story is around, you know, we support genuine sexual violence protests, but we are against criminal elements. So there's already like a criminalization of protest movements. There was interdict taken out, preventing us from shutting down campus. And the difference was that students felt there wasn't an acknowledgement that they were implicated in the problem. And also they were limited in that one of the things that they responded to a lot of the demands that were set by the students, but they refused to suspend the people who were named on the list, which then prolonged the conflict and the protests between students who were protesting and the administration. Because to us, it was like, we have enough communal knowledge that these people are perpetrators of violence and we'd like to see some action taken against that. Mm-hmm. Whereas the university couldn't do that because they needed them to go through the fair disciplinary hearing. Yeah. So I think in terms of what the protest says to me about outcomes is that the disciplinary hearing is a contested way to deal with this. Because what students wanted was something that the university, I don't think, could have given us in terms mm-hmm. of belief. Like, you know, there's that you know, mantra, like believe survivors. And for mm-hmm. us to believe would have been to have action taken against these people on this list without having to go through hoops to prove it. So mm-hmm. there's questions to be asked about what the university can do, given that they have other interests to protect, right? And those questions are being grappled with. And I'm not saying that to absolve the university of what I think was a failure to deal with the problem in a caring manner, but I am mm-hmm. saying that, like, because of the university's interests, it's difficult. It would have been I would almost say, like, we can't expect of them to meet some of the anticipated outcomes because some of those are not possible in the structure that an institution is.
And I think that just goes back to what Joel is saying as well. It's like we can talk about desired outcomes theoretically, but of course those are always going to be impacted by the actual capacity that, you know, the capacity of the institution to deliver a various set of outcomes. And I think there's a really good question here by I think it's Weremu, and I hope I'm saying it correctly, but I think that this question is particularly interesting because I was thinking about it as well. I'll read the question up now, kind of throughout all three talks. You know, Farah had just kind of opened up with these sessions done between three different groups, right? There's lawyers, students, workers. I think when we think of the university and the different stakeholders that the university has, it's easy to think of these stakeholders as kind of pushing against each other. But really, when you kind of think about this very complicated workspace, you know, sexual violence is experienced by people in all, you know, people in all these different groups, whether it be workers or students or faculty or, you know, staff members. It's kind of, it's not just an issue that is experienced among student groups or kind of between student groups. It's a complicated one. And so Romu asks that, I know that you all speak about institutional failures, but they're wondering if anyone has any insight or examples of how these failures have affected organizing and protests. So specifically looking at trust or accountability or vulnerability. And again, they are someone that's participated in the RE reference list, and their observations have been that the difficulty of organizing and solidarity across these social or geographic differences due to the lack of trust between the groups. And I think that's a really, really interesting question, and one that I was thinking about in terms of kind of workers, students, lawyers, as these three separate groups. But you know, what are the opportunities for kind of relationships or solidarities between them? So this question is not addressed to anyone specifically. Is any one of the three panelists kind of have a response to this idea of kind of organizing across differences on campuses?
I'd like to take a stab at it, especially because it's about RU reference list.
Yeah.
I think RU reference list, and I think Fees Must Fall broadly, brought up a lot of conflict amongst organizers. And this is something that I have been impacted by. I think a lot of us have been impacted by, because I think it would be very difficult for the same group of people to ever try stage the same kind of movement again, because a lot of those relationships have broken down. And I think that, like, also, I mean, the cohort of people who were protesting at the time were like 17 to 23 year olds, right? And I think with the passage of time, I've become aware of how we really were not prepared for kind of what we were doing. And also, like, some of the problems around trust, around accountability, you know, it would have been great for us to not even have to have those protests, because encountering those issues was really difficult. And I think that, like, we couldn't really have been prepared, given that we were, like, mostly fresh out of high school. And in terms of, like, thinking of future organizing, which is something I'm still invested in, and thinking about the continuity of movements, it's important to me for people to also think about different levels of relationship. So it's straightforward to me to protest against the university administration, because they kind of have a specific mandate that they have or haven't met, and I can call them on that, right? But the difficulties that I think are related to organizing, as Wairimo is pointing out, is that there's a lot of things that we need to be aware of in terms of, like, horizontal relationships. So if a community member within the protest, as what happened with rape at Azania, is accused of rape, then what happens? And because we were looking hierarchically at the superstructure, I think it's difficult to maintain relationships and maintain, you know, solidarity amongst ourselves when we don't really have a point of reference for how to deal with interpersonal issues within the movement. And I think this is where abolition and abolition feminism really starts to look towards that, because a lot of the justice literature from that perspective seeks to think about the capacity for everyone to harm and what needs to happen in order to have repair within a marginalized community.
No, I mean, that was it's a brilliant answer, and it made me think back to how, you know, Joel opened up his paper with kind of acknowledging the tensions and the complicities and kind of his subject position too. And I mean, I remember during, you know, Fees Must Fall, we were just so desperate for any kind of staff solidarity. And now I'm in, you know, at a London university, and staff members are on strike, and staff members are just so desperate for any kind of student solidarity. And so it's been really interesting for me to be here and kind of witness the opposite of what I had experienced, and kind of see these groups that are, you know, both kind of subject to these same neoliberal, you know, systems, and how there's so little connections for kind of politics to happen between the groups. And it kind of struck me in all three of your papers how important that is. We have one question, Adrija. I just want to know if we have enough time for it. It's a really good closing question.
2 minutes.
Okay. Then I'm so sorry to Farha and Joel, who I really thank, but this question is a perfect kind of closing question for Farha on, you know, the kind of afterlives and the archives of the RU reference list. If there's time for it, Adrija, you'll just have to take control of this because I'm a terrible timekeeper. Or you know what, Adrija, I think that Khorata did speak to this kind of throughout. And if you would like to, you know, take the last 2 minutes to close, then I'll hand it back to you.
I was just about to say we can continue this discussion on Twitter. We have our Fem Dialogues Twitter account, which we can post here and we can continue some of these conversations. But also, this is like one of an ongoing discussion. Before I say more, I just wanted to say thank you, Jess, for an incredible Q&A and for all your insights and thoughts, and our speakers for their incredible presentations and for taking time out and presenting their thoughts and comments with us. We are really, really grateful for this. And again, like I said, this is a part of an ongoing conversation. It's the first panel of a series. So we will definitely continue this conversation. We will also archive this on our website, which will be live very soon. We will collect all the links and resources that you have shared on the chat, put it together in email and email it to everyone who signed up along with the live website. Just also a reminder that we would love any of you who is interested to be involved and be a part of this project. We imagine this project to be a collective project, to be rooted in our communities, to be rooted in feminist struggles and activism and practice. So please reach out to us. Feel free to write to us. You can also get in touch with us through our website or our Twitter accounts. We will be conducting interviews in South Africa from, we will be there physically in South Africa from end of June to end of July. And we will be speaking to academics, students, researchers, practitioners, activists in the areas, in this area, who's working in this area. And we are also like the voices of people with lived experiences are at the center of this research. So please feel free to reach out to us. We would love to hear from you. We are also doing online interviews, telephone interviews. So if you would like to speak to us through the digital medium, also let us know and we can make arrangements according to your needs. Jess, do you want to say something or have I covered everything?
I think you've covered everything. Thanks so much to everyone for being here. It was lovely to see you all.
So that's it from us. Thank you again to Jess, Khorata, Farha, Joel for your time. And you've given us so much to think about. I have like pages and pages of notes that I'm going to take back and reflect on. And everyone who attended and posted such wonderful questions to our panel as well. Thank you and have a good rest of the day. Solidarity.
Thank you so much. Thank you. It was great. Bye.
Could the speakers possibly stay on for like 2 seconds, if you don't mind?
I think Farha has just left. Shall I? I'll just.
Oh, no, Farha's there.
Ah, brilliant.
They're just waiting for everyone to leave and then.
Hello, can you hear me? Hey, can you hear me? Hello?
We can hear you. Yeah.
Hello? Hi, Bianca.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Oh.
Farha, I can hear you.
Okay, great.
Yeah, I think you were asking us to stay on a little bit for a second.
Yeah, hi. Sorry, if that's okay. Let me just quickly. Yeah, perfect. No, I just wanted to say thank you for your time. And this was absolutely brilliant. So just wanted to say a personal thank you as well. And we are so sorry. I forgot to switch on the recording for Hurata. You were just wondering how we can include your presentation. Actually, I'll stop the recording now.